Greetings, bad movie lovers, and welcome to a special sneak preview of one of the new members-only series here at the show, Bimon Sci-Fi Con.
That's right, it's Bimon Sci-Fi Con!
Join me and my co-host Stephanie Kennerly, who you may remember from such episodes as Volcano, Sudden Death, and Life, as we get together twice a month to venture across the landscape of science fiction from the astounding to the absurd. Last time out, we covered one of the all-time great sci-fi movies in Contact, but this time out, we're on the opposite side of the spectrum, talking about David Tuohy's The Arrival from 1996. Please enjoy this sneak preview. Stardate 1996, Pasadena, California, by way of Hidalgo, Mexico. It's David Tuohy's The Arrival.
Very important to emphasize the "the" on that one.
Very, very important. I couldn't just say "the." I had to make it emphatic with a "the."
Yeah, I actually had a spelling test when I was in the second grade, and one of the words was "the." And when the teacher read it off for us to write it down, she said "the," and I got really confused, and I wrote "tha." Yeah, I digress. Anyway, back to The Arrival. The Arrival.
Yeah, which actually predates Contact, and I pushed play. It was on Hoopla, so the library service has this movie. And one, I wanted to see what I did and didn't remember about the film. I kind of knew the broad strokes. I was like, okay, I know Charlie's here. I know there's a satellite dish. I knew enough of the tangible, maybe superficial connections for me to recommend this after Contact, which in hindsight I don't think was a good decision. However, I will stick to the fact that there was no other time that we were going to circle back to this movie, I don't think. So it was the only time that we were going to do The Arrival.
I think it fits really well because the SETI stuff is like, I didn't remember it was so exactly yes. Like both on the nose with like SETI procedure and like some of the same dialogue because, you know, there's only certain amounts of ways to say technical things. Yeah. So same here. When I was rewatching it, I was like, oh yeah. I mean, I remembered there was he made the satellite dishes into a telescope array. And I was like, yeah, there's an array in Contact, and here there's The Arrival. We've got an array here too. But I hadn't remembered that it was just like so heavy on that sounds stupid for me to say this movie was heavy on the science, but it at least presents the science in the similar science in a superficial manner in the form of technical jargon, but maybe the kind of thing that we wouldn't have noticed had we not just watched Contact, but we did. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my rewatch.
it was not a bad time rewatching it, but I feel like the shadow of Contact is just like looming so large, and having just re-listened and edited the entirety of that discussion on Contact, it just left this movie feeling kind of shallow in comparison.
Sure.
And I think that is fair. By the time we get to the end of it, I think most people would probably agree that that is the case. And, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. But in this case, like, I really don't have a choice because I'm watching the movie thinking, did David Tuohy read the Carl Sagan book, not get the rights, and then just was like, okay, I know they're making it, but I'm going to rush to get mine done first? And I wouldn't be surprised, because there is a shot at one point in the movie where I think it's looking at like a radio or a TV or something, and you can see propped up against...
Yes, the Carl Sagan book. Yeah, yes. Cosmos sitting
there. So I'm just like, okay, like I feel like this is definitely aware of that identity in telling this story, but obviously goes in a very, very drastically different direction than Contact does.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, like, it's hard to present the subject matter without at least giving a nod to Carl Sagan. So I think that's kind of what that was doing there. And like you said, it's superficially got some similarities, but nobody would say they're like the same movie. it definitely distinguishes itself in an interesting direction.
Yeah. And I don't even know if I saw this first or not, but I did have some very distinct memories because obviously the backwards knees thing.
Yes, the like flamingo legs.
Yeah, because flamingos are such great high jumpers. There is a sort of visceral connection to that element of this movie, in that the way it presents its aliens is much more focused on actually presenting them. Whereas in Contact, it is sort of a spiritual nature. And then even in the interaction with the alien, it's more of contextualized through the human experience rather than being this external thing that's meant to wow you. So it's just a very different type of approach. And I was watching some interviews for this, and it was, I forget what, Bobby Wygant, interviewer from like 80s and 90s. And she's sitting down with Tom Smith, who ran Industrial Light and Magic for several years, and he worked on E.T. And they were talking about the design choices here in this film. And there's a moment during the interview where she is talking about the CGI and she says, "You can't tell what's real and what's computer generated." And I like lost my shit. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, either you are just blowing smoke right up his ass because you want to have a good interview, or you've never seen CGI before. Because I think one of the most egregious things that happens when watching this movie in hindsight is that the visual effects are very poor.
Yeah. And it's not like this was 3 years after Jurassic Park. So we've seen good CGI, you know, we've seen what it can be when they take their time with it. And yeah, no, not this. So I disagree with Bobby Wygant. Girl.
I think there are some moments where it's used well, but during that conversation, I think what I found interesting with Tom Smith is that having the experience that he had working on E.T. and then talking about the budget and having to make financial considerations, the idea that doing it digitally was going to look better, when at this time, like, you still have really good puppeteers and makeup guys. And I couldn't help but watch the movie thinking of how much better it would be had they designed just a couple of alien suits. You make the aliens taller, and I mean, you know, you just put them on stilts. And so you just have the stilts angled so it looks like the backwards knee. But that way, when they're face to face, you actually have like a real costumed performer and you can make him all shiny or whatever the hell you need to do. But yeah, a lot of the CGI choices with this movie, I get that you had to do it for some moments, but a lot of it just felt like it's going to be expensive. And judging by that conversation, I think that's what ultimately happened, was having puppeteers and or costume makeup, the time it takes to put people in costume and makeup like that would have taken some time. But then I think of like something like Tank Girl, right, that has like kangaroo people that they commissioned a $5,000 kangaroo penis for that movie that didn't. Yes, the look on your face is appropriate.
Yeah.
They didn't actually end up using it, but somewhere
they didn't use it. That's great.
Didn't use it, right? Well,
some collector ended up with kangaroo penis in his, you know, rec room.
Look, I can't say I'm not curious. What did they design for this? But in just the notion that during the mid 90s, there were films being made where big costumes and prosthetics still looked good. I mean, you know, you had Predator in the 80s. You had the second Predator in the early 90s. I mean, you had Terminator 2 in the early 90s with like a full moving skeleton, right? It's not that it wasn't possible. It's just that like it would be expensive. So the decision to keep the cost down was to do it all through CGI. And I think it ends up doing it something of a disservice, especially later in the movie where we need Charlie to be interacting with somebody else on camera. And there just like isn't somebody there. And like that's when it becomes like really, really noticeable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they needed to save money because they needed to get the quality actor that is Charlie Sheen.
This is true.
They needed money to pay him. So that's what stuck with me from when I knew The Arrival from as a kid. You know, this was definitely an HBO watch for me. And like thinking back on it, I thought about the bad CGI, and that was like the flavor that stayed in my mouth for, you know, 20 years or however long it's been since I saw it. So that when I did the rewatch, I was actually like, wow, this is more of a substantial story than I remember. Like it wasn't as hokey as I was expecting it to be, which was kind of an interesting place to be in. Cause when you proposed it, I was like, oh yeah, The Arrival, that's so bad. I'm so excited about it. But then I was like, actually, it's not super bad. It's got a story to tell, you know?
Yeah. It's in more of the middle range. I probably, if I really ran the numbers, it probably would be a movie that I could just talk about on the show normally. Cause it's got a 6.2 IMDb, if Metascore 56, I think I saw the Letterboxd is like a 2.8. So it's in the high five, low six range. So yeah, I could make it work, but it isn't that it's necessarily a bad movie. Like you said, there is a lot going on, and there's like maybe too much going on for the size of the budget and the capabilities of what this movie actually was able to do, right? They wanted to have the exotic thing in Mexico. Like you said, Charlie Sheen cost them $5 million of their $22 million budget, which Tom Smith was very happy to point out that 20% of their spending went to the star. So you've got, I feel like it was a dig a little bit, like they wanted to do something more, but they wasted money on Charlie Sheen is the way that comment sort of came off to me. But to have a story that isn't just about sort of discovering this signal and going through the channels of bureaucracy that are stopping you from getting to the bottom of this, and then uncovering a conspiracy, and then running into aliens, actual aliens, and then to find out that this whole global warming commentary is actually just the aliens terraforming our planet while they're playing like ads for terraforming at like several other moments during the film. They're talking about terraforming Mars, and it's like so there's just like there's so much going on, and I feel like I appreciate that it was ambitious, but you know, sometimes ambition gets in the way of like making reasonable decisions.
Yeah, I you know, it's impossible not to come into these rewatches with our baggage for what's going on today. Yeah. And I definitely, with the whole global warming commentary, I was like, yeah, if this had been made today, it would definitely be called woke. but back then it was just, I don't know, a storyline. But personally, I wish that the explanation for climate change was as easy as there are aliens trying to terraform our planet, because that's a much easier fix, in my opinion, than having to get humans to change their behavior. Yeah.
These Wolf 336 bastards are making alien farts in the fucking fart factory in Mexico. I don't like, yes. They're just big old gas balls.
Yes, greenhouse gases that are actually green. They're literally green.
Thank you for checking out this preview episode of Bi-Mon Sci-Fi Con. I look forward to embarking on this journey with Stephanie, and I hope you had a good time with us too. If you did, you can join the Resistance members only and get more exclusives like Bad Movie Futures, Rom-Comathon, and anything else I decide to tack on by clicking on the link in the show notes or going to badmovieswelove.captivate.fm/support. Thank you for listening. Be good. Do good. Take care, everybody.
Mr. Pop.